In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 405. I'm going to talk a little bit about Amtrak today. I'm a little slow in getting to this, but eventually I'll be better with current events, doing my best to keep up with the world. But, of course, we know what the standard response is going to be to a train derailment or to anything that happens in the public sector. It needs more money. Now, if there had been a private sector disaster, people would be demanding that heads should roll. But if it's a public sector disaster, it's more money. They need to have more money. And everybody seems to be getting swept up in this. This just goes to show that we've been dominated by right-wingers who don't care about the common good, and they just want to keep their money so they can roll around in it. And it's the usual thing. Happens all the time. So I want to go through some of the information that's relevant to understanding this question. And to help me do that, I have an article here that I'm going to put on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/405, by David Stockman. Now, David Stockman, very early on when he was a junior staffer on Capitol Hill, had as an early project the analysis of the enabling legislation that created Amtrak in the first place in the early 1970s. So he knows a lot about this. He's been around with this thing for quite some time. He knows a lot about it. And he's our guest tomorrow, by the way. Now, I could have just talked to David about Amtrak when I had him on tomorrow, but I've got a really juicy topic to talk about with David. I'm just going to leave it there. I guarantee you, you're going to want to hear tomorrow's episode. So if you haven't subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher, please do so via the links at tomwoods.com. It's going to be fantastic. Oh, what the heck, I'll just tell you. Tomorrow, I'm going to have Stockman on. Now, you all know David Stockman. He was the former director of the Office of Management and Budget. That was under Ronald Reagan from 1981 to 1985. He had a famous falling out with Reagan because of the deficit issue at that time. He has since become just an Austrian analyst extraordinaire in terms of his financial commentary. He really is top-notch. And tomorrow, I'm going to ask him to review some of the claims that we hear a lot on progressive websites and on pro-Democratic Party websites, saying that really the economic performance under Barack Obama has actually been pretty strong. And that it's really just right-wing naysayers who refuse to accept this. That actually he's got a pretty darn good record considering what he inherited. And we get this quite a bit. Like, look, we've had this growth, we've had job growth, the stock market's doing well, so what are these people griping about? Well, we'll tell you what we're griping about tomorrow. I'm going to raise all those objections one at a time with David, and he is going to bat them down. And it's going to be one of these episodes that helps you build up your arsenal of arguments to use when people come after you. So that's tomorrow. If you're not subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher, you may miss that episode. And think of how terrible you'll feel years down the road when it suddenly dawns on you that you missed that episode. So I want to review some of the information in today's episode that we find in particularly in this article by Stockman, so that I have time to talk to him about the Obama thing, which I think that's a really good topic. Let's respond to some of these so-called progressive claims. Well, early on in the history of Amtrak, everybody was assured, as typically happens in this kind of situation, that this program would be in the black, that is, running a surplus, within a matter of just several years. But, in fact, that has never happened. It's never happened. It's never been in the black. It's always been in the red. Now, here's the key point. Amtrak has 44 routes, but on every one of these 44 routes, people have alternatives. They can travel by bus. They can travel by air, not to mention automobiles. Of course, we're not supposed to like those, but they do exist. And it's also a fact that passenger trains, at least with the technology we're aware of, don't seem as if they could really be viable as economic competitors to these other modes of transportation, other than in possibly a handful of very densely populated areas. And even there, there's an issue that we'll get to in a minute. Amtrak has enjoyed a subsidy of approximately $75 billion over the years, and it is operating around 40 routes that have never even made what's called an operating profit. But as Stockman notes, the operating profit test is itself a red herring, because there's another aspect of profitability that needs to be considered, and that is how capital intensive Amtrak is and how costly it would be to replace its capital stock. So Stockman says that it maintains 21,000 miles of track, 100 rail stations, operates around 2,500 locomotives and passenger cars, and requires an extensive, costly infrastructure of communications and signaling systems, electric traction networks, and a huge array of bridges, tunnels, switching yards, repair facilities, fencing, and other right-of-way improvements and ancillary buildings. On a replacement basis, its entire capital asset base would easily amount to $50 billion, about $40 billion of track and infrastructure, and $10 billion of rolling stock. Now, he goes on to say that even if we make a fairly generous assumption about the depreciation of this capital, you're talking about depreciation amounting to about $2 billion per year. Now, every year, Amtrak generates about 8 billion passenger miles. So that means that the capital consumption expense of $2 billion per year is itself about 25 cents per passenger mile. And here's where Stockman is going with this. If you look at the average airline fare in the U.S. or the average bus fare, well, the average airline fare is about 15 cents per passenger mile, and the average bus fare is about 11 cents per passenger mile. So how would it make sense to take this passenger rail system and shove subsidies at it when just the economic cost of the capital assets is anywhere from 65 to 130% higher than the fares that are being charged by the entirely profitable and obviously adequate alternative modes of transportation we've just mentioned? But there's still more to consider here. Stockman points out the wage and benefits tab at Amtrak. Well, there you're talking about $2 billion per year spread out over 20,000 employees. So do that math and you realize that you're coming out with an average of $100,000 per employee. Now, that is nowhere, that is so far remote from earnings in the airline industry and in the bus industry, that this is another massive expense that can go on existing only thanks to taxpayer subsidy. Then you've got another $1.3 billion of expenses related to fuel, power, utilities, supplies, repair parts, and operational and management overheads. So its total operating budget is $3.3 billion, and that amounts to about 40 cents of expense per passenger mile. So its operating costs are 3 to 4 times the ticket price of its competitors in air and bus. Then there are implicit subsidies that Amtrak gets on top of the $75 billion. They're required to get special treatment. And I'll put it this way. 95% of Amtrak's route miles and 70% of its passenger miles, says Stockman, are generated on lines leased from freight railroads, which, thanks to regulatory mandates, Amtrak pays only a trivial 2 cents per passenger mile. This does not remotely reflect the real economic costs. So the long and the short of it is, Amtrak's ticket revenues amount to barely 30 cents per passenger mile. So Amtrak has not nearly reached break-even levels, as it claims. Its revenues are covering less than 45% of its overall cost to society. Now, some people have said, well, why don't we just scale it back and just have the more or less profitable Northeastern routes continue? But there, you've got 10 cents of so-called operating profits per passenger mile. But if you add in the capital costs, then even these so-called profitable lines are still, as Stockman says, deeply underwater. He notes that, just choosing almost at random, the Chicago-Los Angeles route has operating costs of 35 cents per passenger mile, and if you add the capital consumption issue, then you're talking at least 50 cents per mile. But the problem is that you can fly between Chicago and Los Angeles, in today's fares anyway, for about $200, which is about 11 cents per mile, and you don't have to be stuck on a train for 22 hours. And then finally, he points out the real politics of Amtrak. And he talks about his time in the Reagan administration, and then afterward, that there's always this desire to keep the pork barrel going. So if the federal government comes under budget constraints, which, once in a blue moon, maybe it does, how are politicians going to decide how the limited money should be spent? And the answer will be, we got to keep all the routes running because we want to keep votes coming in from all the people who benefit from those routes at the expense of the rest of the country. We got to keep the routes going. So we'll just keep, we'll simply keep the capital maintenance fund low and instead just keep all the routes going. When in fact, any private business firm would do exactly the opposite. We close down the unprofitable routes and we keep our capital maintenance up so that the thing remains safe and we can continue to use it for years into the future. This is not the way the political class thinks. This is not the way the incentives that exist in politics, that exist when government is involved, period. That's not the way they think. It's not the way they operate. My friend Chris Wesley points out in an article from some years ago that Amtrak is a very visible government service. And it's a helpful symbol for the federal government to be able to indicate to people, look, you do get something from the federal government. You know, you are getting goodies. And this is particularly important in the Northeast because, for instance, Connecticut gets 63 cents for every dollar it sends to the U.S. government. New Jersey gets 67 cents back for every dollar it sends. So there's a need to have there be a very visible presence there that, well, look, you got Amtrak. That's something. And this is the way government consistently behaves. Now, what about infrastructure in general? Well, Stockman's got a good piece on this, too. I will link to this also at tomwoods.com/405. He says that when you're talking about infrastructure, he says, arguably the only thing Washington has any business being involved with is the interstate highway system. Now, even that is questionable. In the book I wrote with Kevin Gutzman, Who Killed the Constitution, believe it or not, we actually go after the interstate highway system. If you could imagine something that would be as unpopular as possible, a position to take, that's the position we take in that book. If I remember, I will link also to Who Killed the Constitution, and I will link also to episodes in which we've talked about road privatization on this show. So bearing in mind that I don't think David Stockman is a privatize the roads guy, nevertheless, we can appreciate some of his points. He says that the interstate highway system can basically be more than adequately maintained for $30 billion a year. And it accounts for only 1.1% of the 4 million miles of streets, roads, and highways in the entire country. The other 99% is taken care of on the local level. He says the unheralded truth is the current gas tax generates more than enough to fund the interstate system. That is, before 70% of the incoming trust fund dollars are dissipated on mass transit, bike paths, beautification, and state and local highways, which should be funded by local users or taxpayers. He shows that nationwide highway spending has averaged between $80 and $85 billion since 2009, or about 25% higher in real terms than a decade earlier. And then finally, though, what about all the crumbling bridges? Right, our bridges are all falling down, right? I'm going to actually read you the section on the crumbling bridges. This is something that he wrote a while back and then reproduced again in this particular article. But let's talk about it. He says, there is the mythology about crumbling bridges based on the occasional bridge failure that becomes a momentary cable news sensation, but is not representative of the actual facts. Indeed, the crumbling bridge myth deserves debunking, especially because it has become a metaphor for the entire phony campaign for massive infrastructure spending and borrowing. And then he goes on to repeat this analysis he gave not long ago. He says, it seems that after 32 years and tens of billions of federal funding, that the nation's bridges are still crumbling and in grave disrepair. In fact, according to Department of Transportation and industry lobbies, there are 63,000 bridges across the nation that are structurally deficient, suggesting that millions of motorists are at risk for a perilous dive into the drink. But here's the thing. Roughly one-third, or 20,000 of these purportedly hazardous bridges, are located in six rural states in America's midsection: Iowa, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota. The fact that these states account for only 5.9% of the nation's population seems more than a little incongruous, but that isn't even half the puzzle. It seems that these thinly populated country provinces have a grand total of 118,000 bridges. That is, one bridge for every 160 citizens, men, women, and children included. And the biggest bridge state among them is, well, yes, Iowa. The state has 3 million souls and nearly 25,000 bridges, one for every 125 people. So suddenly the picture is crystal clear. These are not the kind of bridges that thousands of cars and heavy-duty trucks pass over each day. No, they are mainly the kind Clint Eastwood needed a local farm wife to locate so he could take pictures for a National Geographic spread on covered bridges. Stated differently, the overwhelming bulk of the 600,000 so-called bridges in America are so little used that they are more often crossed by dogs, cows, cats, and tractors than they are by passenger motorists. They are essentially no different than local playgrounds and municipal parks. They have nothing to do with interstate commerce, GDP growth, or national public infrastructure. If they are structurally deficient, as measured by engineering standards, that is not exactly a mystery to the host village, township, and county governments, which choose not to upgrade them. So if Iowa is content to live with 5,000 bridges, one in five of its 25,000 bridges, that are deemed structurally deficient by the Department of Transportation, why is this a national crisis? Self-evidently, the electorate and officialdom of Iowa do not consider these bridges to be a public safety hazard, or something would have been done long ago. The evidence for that is in another startling fun fact about the nation's bridges. Compared to the 19,000 so-called structurally deficient bridges in the six rural states reviewed here, there are also 19,000 such deficient bridges in another group of 35 states, including Texas, Maryland, Massachusetts, Virginia, Washington, Oregon, Michigan, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, New Jersey, and Wisconsin, among others. But these states have a combined population of 175 million, not 19 million as in the six rural states, and more than 600 citizens per bridge, not 125 as in Iowa. Moreover, only 7% of the bridges in these 35 states are considered to be structurally deficient, rather than 21% as in Iowa. So the long and the short of it is self-evident. Iowa still has a lot of one-horse bridges, and Massachusetts, with 1,300 citizens per bridge, does not. None of this is remotely relevant to a national infrastructure crisis today, any more than it was in 1982, when even Ronald Reagan fell for 23,000 bridges in need of replacement or rehabilitation. Yes, the few thousands of bridges actually used heavily in commerce and passenger transportation in America do fall into disrepair and need periodic reinvestment. But the proof that even this is an overwhelmingly state and local problem is evident in another list maintained by the Department of Transportation. That list would be a rank ordering called the Most Traveled Structurally Deficient Bridges 2013. These are the opposite of the covered bridges of Madison County, but even here there is a cautionary tale. It seems that of the 100 most heavily traveled bridges in the U.S. by rank order and which are in need of serious repair, 80% of them are in California. Moreover, they are overwhelmingly state highway and municipal road and street bridges located in Los Angeles, Orange County, and the Inland Empire. Stated differently, Governor Moonbeam has not miraculously solved California's endemic fiscal crisis. He's just neglected the local infrastructure. There is no obvious reason why taxpayers in Indiana or North Carolina need to be fixing California's bridges so that it can continue to finance its outrageously costly public employee pension system. And so it goes with the rest of the so-called infrastructure slate. There is almost nothing there that is truly national in scope, and little that is in a state of crumbling and crisis. So what it really boils down to then, it turns out, is that this whole outcry for more infrastructure spending has a lot more to do with Keynesianism than with anything else. The idea that if we just spend a lot of money and borrow a lot of money, this generates great economic effects. Now, they've already gone and destroyed Japan with this kind of juvenile mentality that we simply transfer resources from some people to others, and this magically gets things going again. That has basically wrecked Japan's fiscal situation completely. They have basically nothing to show for these sorts of projects. But that's ultimately what it's all about. All right, that's today's episode. Make sure you're here tomorrow for the David Stockman Obamanomics Smackdown, which some of your friends will need. And of course, remember, I have a brand new ebook. Not brand new, if you guys have been listening to the show for a while, but some of you new listeners, it's brand new to you. Came out a few months ago, called 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered. And you can get that free ebook by texting the word liberty to 33444. And you'll also get my free letter that goes out every week on the show, and here's what we're talking about on the show, and things that I'm up to, and items of interest to you guys. And of course, if you hate that, you can stop getting it. It's very easy, just one click. And then meanwhile, you got yourself a free ebook that will help answer some common objections to libertarianism. So just text the word liberty to 33444, and that baby will be on its way. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.